Mr. Black, Reel 15. You arrived in Egypt. What were your first impressions of Egypt?
Well, you really, when you arrived, you didn't see much of Egypt as such. You saw a British Army base. I mean, it had been a terrifically big base for them. And there was the army camps, etc. We did get the chance to go into, while we were there, when we got to our final destination, which was El Bala, you got the chance to have a 24-hour probably in Port Said, or a trip down the banks of the Suez Canal to Ishmaelia, and the surrounding kind of the bit with the Bitter Lakes, and we had the Sweetwater Canal running alongside, which was out of bounds to everybody. Apparently, if you got in there, you got all sorts of things crawling into all sorts of openings, so you avoided that. The population around the camps was very, very much the peasant population. Port Said was quite a lively place, and of course, obviously a big trading place, and rather more civilised, in fact, very civilised, but you still got the haves and the have-nots there, very much in evidence. When we did eventually leave Mina, our first camp was at Kassassin. That was a big army base. We picked up our shorts and in preparation to get our knees browned, as they used to say. Picked up tropical gear. Had lectures on hygiene and how to behave there and what to avoid. We know what that means. And eventually from there we went to El Bala, which was quite a big camp, but that was right on the side of the Suez Canal. In fact, from your hut you wave to the ships going by. And it was nice to see occasionally merchant vessels that you knew from that you'd seen in the Tyne and this sort of thing, the bigger ones, like Savella Dempster Lines and those sort of places, and the vessels that used to ply to Australia. They were very, very interesting there. As I say, we used to get up into Haifa and into Port Said. From there, we got orders to go into Palestine, and we were prepared for to cross the northern Sinai Desert to get there. We crossed the Suez Canal, and I've had many an argument with people who you can't cross the Suez Canal. There was no bridges on the Suez Canal, but there was a railway bridge which had been adapted for transport, and we definitely went across it. We didn't have the waters divided or anything here across. There was a bridge. We stopped in going through the Sinai at various transit camps on the way. There were properly organised transit camps where we could top up the vehicles with petrol and replenish the water supplies and the rations for the other journey. And eventually, we arrived in Palestine, as it was then, for really my last permanent or semi-permanent billet while I was in the army. This was at Hadera. It was a northern town in Palestine, now of course in Israel, and it wasn't very far from the Coast Guard station at Givat Olga, which I'll come back to later on about that. It was a hutted camp, quite good facilities, decent barracks and the accommodation. We had, once again, we had a good, in this time, it was a regimental sergeant's mess. Quite a good facility. We got the routine then again of maintenance, instruction, and slightly more spit and polish than we'd been used to. Our guns were sighted around the camp and at vulnerable sites in the area, in particular the one that I've just mentioned, the Coast Guard station at Givat Olga. This station was quite well known. It was equipped with ground radar, and this radar successfully picked up most of the illegal immigrant ships that used to sail in with thousands of people on board, and gave one to the Navy, and they were escorted into Haifa. And consequently, as a result of this, it was a target for the terrorists. Two of these terror groups, which are well known, the Stern Gang and the Ergun's Wild Army, were really active. And the station was twice blown up while we were there. The first time when just after we got there, and it was quickly repaired. There wasn't a lot of damage done, and it was quickly repaired. But the second time, they made sure it was going to be really put out of commission. It was never established, but it was thought at the time that when they'd done the repair and rebuilt it, that they'd actually placed explosives, built-in explosives one, because obviously most of them were Jewish contractors that were doing it. They were supervised by our own engineers, but I mean, they had the chance. Whether or not that was correct, I don't know, but it's certainly feasible, because the next one, it wasn't just a single bomb. More or less the whole of the station collapsed. We had, in a way, we were fortunate, because a lot of the heavier beams that came down, when I went to have a look at it after it happened, had fallen between the beds. The beds at the time weren't occupied. There was only one or two in the hood, because they're on stand two outside. But we did have casualties there, including one of our gunners that was killed. It was Gunner Stan Lamb. He was a nice guy, quiet fella, and his normal job was driving the water truck. I mean, he wasn't. He was a fighting man. He was in there. He was trained for it. But I mean, he had a sort of innocuous sort of job, and yet he was put on guard there and lost it. It didn't, you know.
And he was killed in this explosion, was he?
He was killed in the explosion. Yes. He was buried with full military honours the next year, and I had the job then. If we hadn't done it before, because obviously if we buried anybody in the Northwest campaign, there was no time for full military honours, but he was, and I had the job together with the RSM of training the honours firing party. He's buried in a cemetery quite close to Haifa. There's one or two others injured, but not too badly. We did quite a lot of patrols in the area, obviously looking for terrorists, but in the main, to make our presence felt. We used to board public transport with the patrol, but always in the company of the British Palestine Police, because they were the force for law and order, being a British protectorate. And they examine identifications on the buses and this. And you weren't the civilian population weren't too happy with that either side, either the Jews or the Arabs. It was nothing to be spat at or something like that in a nasty sort. It was most uncomfortable. We didn't feel very comfortable doing this sort. We had to do it.
And you wouldn't be able to retaliate.
You couldn't retaliate. You didn't retaliate.
So you're in the middle?
Oh, yes. We're definitely in the middle all the way through. You didn't know who you... Okay, in Northwest, you knew who you were fighting. You didn't here. Could have been either side. Literally, as you say, we're piggy in the middle. Part of our job while we were there, periodically, we moved a troop from the camp up into the hills of northern Palestine. And there was there was caves along there which were obviously used by the terrorists. They knew that. And we used to do an exercise there where we took a troop of guns up at a one troop at a time. We went up and we engaged with the infantry in an exercise, but it was an exercise with a purpose as well. What we'd do, we'd go up, lay, sight the guns on, onto the cave at a fixed bearing, fire one or two rounds to see, so the officer at the OP could see where they were landing, and then take a reading on the bearing and the elevation scales. That was noted. We'll come to the reason for that later on. They popped off several rounds during the day occasionally. Not an awful lot. This was in the exercise. Was obviously anyone that was there, if the infantry was going to put an assault on it, that sort of fire kept the heads down. At night time, oyster fire, and it was more sustained. Principally for the thought that if the caves were going to occupy, probably they would go in and hide out at night time in them. So it was a more sustained rate of fire, but also with quite a lot of tracer, because it made it signalled a line of advance for the infantry to that particular target. There didn't seem to be any, for the first time, no restriction on the amount of ammunition that we used. We just went went ahead with it.
Did you find anyone in the caves?
No. Well, we never actually got up to the caves. We fired that, whether or not they did, because it was right on the borders, of course, of Palestine, and I don't think they wanted the chance of anybody straying over the border. There obviously would be investigative patrols, or probably infantry or someone would go up there, but we certainly didn't. The nearest I got to that place was that Tiny Marriott got some information that there was champagne available at in the foothills, and he decided that one night we would go out in the jeep as a patrol, but he wanted to get his hands on a few bottles of champagne. I don't remember getting any, but that was him. When they did the troop shoot there, each time they went, I was always called into the OC's office. Right, Sergeant Major, we're going up into the foothills. Doesn't matter what troop was there. He wanted to be there with it. He, as I say, he was a soldier, and he wanted to be where the action was. He wasn't content to sit in an office or anything like that. So we spent quite a bit of time up on the foothills there. The events there were never quite like that of a peacetime army, because, as I mentioned before, we're in constant danger from both sides. But we did maintain some normality. We had local leave provided with transport to Haifa. It was quite a nice town, and there was one or two Nafis and Salvation Army canteens and this sort of thing there. We spent quite a pleasant time. We used to visit Tadira in the evenings. Again, there was Nafi, etc., because there's a little local pubs. And principally what we enjoyed most, we'd hadn't had much access to for years, was a local cinema. Showing some oldest films, of course, with the Jewish subtitles on the bottom.
Could you move around the town in relative safety?
Well, you moved around the town. I mean, it's wrong to say that everyone was against us. I mean, we met some quite nice people. I mean, you go into a cafe or anything, and always from the Jews it was shalom, and you weren't ignored by either side. But it's like the thing that's happening now with the terrorists. It's the minority every time. In the main, both the Jews and Arabs, the Arab children around the camp at Adira, they were great. I mean, they made the chaps from home who had families and all that made a great lot of the kids. But of course, again, they got the chocolates and they got this set. Naturally, they were going to come round, but they were quite nice. And
did you have to go about armed?
Oh yes, we had arms at all time, rifled and sidearms. You were on constant alert. We were constantly vigilant. We did it apart from the station at Givet Olga. We didn't have any really traumatic times within the regiment. I mean, while we were there, the King David Hotel in Jerusalem was blown up. The headquarters of the division at Haifa was blown up. There was bombs in the port of Haifa all around us, but we never had anything in our actual camp. While we're there, we're allowed the choice of a few days leave, and we could either go to Cyprus, where they flew them out for 2 or 3 days. Or we could have a tour of, what is the Holy Land, the historical and holy sites, and I opted for that, and I'm pleased I did, because it was most interesting. We had a very good army chaplain and a good Jewish guide, and we travelled all over that area, particularly all the places in Jerusalem. Stations of the Cross, or the Church of the Annunciation, and we also the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and the Garden Tomb, on the outskirts, Golgotha, and literally there, when we looked, it was the place of the skull. You looked at the rock formation, and there was definitely a skull there. Of course, I mean, it hasn't been established that was the actual site. You have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. They've all got pros and cons. We went to Bethlehem, the Church of the Nativity, Nazareth, Dead Sea, Tiberias. We had a real good tour of the area, and we finished up actually in Jerusalem, and I've got a good photograph of the group that we finished off with, which is probably the last photograph we had of people in the unit before we demobbed. As I mentioned before, we're in a constant state of vigilance, but I quite enjoyed my stay in Palestine. And of course then, it was time for Group 27 to be demobbed. Just before my demob date came up, I was called into the battery office and said that if I would, I had a choice, if I'd like to sign on for a further 5 years. Major Marriott, Tiny Marriott, said, I can guarantee you a commission. But after 6.5 years, I'm afraid home was beginning to pull, and I said, no, thank you. On reflection, it was probably a wise move, because I believe that quite a lot of the people who did sign on for that 5 or 7 years, you had the choice, eventually ended up in the Korean conflict. So But as I say, it was tempting, but I really had sufficient, and you wanted to be home, and so I finally left the regiment with the last remaining TA men. After we left, there wasn't a TA man from the start of the war left with the regiment. We all left. There was myself, a battery sergeant major, troop sergeant major, Stan Street, and two or three sergeants. There was only three or four gunners actually left together, and that was the final of the TA with 112.
What day did you leave?
We left there about the was about the 22nd of March, because I know we spent 9 days getting home. We travelled by way of Portside, Malta. We've joined a troop ship at Portside, stopped off at Malta, and then to Toulon. We crossed by rail to Paris, spent an overnight in Paris, then to Dieppe, then to New Haven, and finally to Aldershot. And I was demobbed there on the 1st of April, 1946.
What was the process of demobilisation?
Oh, it was, again, a sausage machine. You started at one end, handing your army gear in. You were taken down the line. First of all, somebody took your measurements for a suit. You're given the option of keeping certain parts of your army gear if you wanted. You kept the uniform you stood up in. You're given the choice of getting a civilian grade coat or keeping your army grade coat. Well, the civilian grade coats were no great shape, so I kept my army grade coat. You were given the suit, the shirt, the inevitable Trilby hat. I'd never worn a hat in my life, but I came out with a Trilby hat. And then, of course, you were processed on the admin side, given a certain amount of money for your leave, and then put on the your ticket for the train. And
did you have a medical?
You had a medical. We had a medical before we left the unit with our own MO, and then you were given when you first got to Aldershot, you had a quick medical then, and you were asked if you had anything you wanted to report, any injuries or this sort of thing.
Did you get gratuities for?
Oh, you got a gratuity, yes. I think mine amounted to altogether about £98. It was dependent on your length of service, and then you had 90 days leave, and you had to pay for that leave. It didn't seem an awful lot at the time, but when you think in relation, it was. A fair sum, I would imagine. I mean, it served us for quite some time. You didn't actually pick that up there. That was sent to you through the a warrant for to go and pick it up at the post office.
Did you find it difficult settling down?
Not really. I mean, I had written to the place where I worked before the war and asked if my job was there, and I was assured that it was. I went back to the job. But the startling thing for me there is when I got when I started work and got to know what my pay, etc. was, I was getting more in the army as a sergeant major than I was picking up in the civilian job, plus the fact I was being kept in the army. So early days of demob, it became a bit of a struggle. I mean, my wages were more or less in line with everyone else's. course, there hadn't been a great increase of wages during the war, obviously. There wasn't the runaway inflation, I suppose, that there has been since.
So would you say were the best things that you got out of army life?
The best things out of army life was certainly the comradeship. That has lasted me all the way through. I mean, I made really good friends, both with officers. I'd made quite a lot of friends in the army. I mean, one of the chaps I was in the territorial with, he was a lifelong friend until he died about 10 years ago. His family became friends. Another one was my troop clerk, who came from Sheffield, but who had settled in Plymouth, and I spent a long time with him afterwards, 2 holidays a year, probably down at his place or up here. And again, that lasted until he died. Quite a lot of the people that I was with, also with me, joined the Fellowship of the Services, which is continuing to this day, all ex-servicemen. Most of them had experienced the living together in barracks and this sort of thing, and it got really close. It's something that you probably don't find in the present-day forces. There were really... Well, I've put it this way. I wish the war hadn't happened, but it did, and I was pleased that I was there.